Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, and I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies, which are changed forever with friends.
As always, thanks to everyone who is listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. We picked up a bunch of new paying members with this week's bonus episode ranking the Star Wars movies, which is nice. It got us within spitting distance of the top 10 on the film and TV subsection of Substack. And my understanding is that once you break into the top 10, Steven Spielberg is literally required to come to your podcast and do an interview with you. We have reserved Howard the Duck. So we get into the top 10. We got Spielberg on Howard the Duck coming up. So let's make it happen, folks. And now on to controversies and non-controversies. Except this week, we're going to do things a little different. There's no non. We're just looking into the future, maybe. Because May of 2026 is one of those months that someone will write a book about one day, maybe soon. It's a little like the Oscars of 1968 and how they turned out to be the perfect synecdoche for a changing film industry, as seen in Mark Harris's fantastic book, Pictures at a Revolution. I told Alyssa and Peter this is weekend that somebody writes a book about, but I really think the story actually begins back on May 1. This is a month somebody writes a book about, right? Because that's the day that Netflix announced it was giving Greta Gerwig's Narnia movie a full theatrical run with a 49-day window, which is an unprecedented move in the streamer's history. And that in turn led them to say that earlier this month, at the end of May, they were also like, oh, we're also going to put David Fincher's Cliff Booth, Quentin Tarantino movie into the IMAX spot on Thanksgiving, which is obviously a big deal for everyone. So that's kind of interesting. But like Netflix's apparent belated realization that there's actually money to be made in the $10 billion theatrical business is yet to play out. We don't know what's going to happen with that. Maybe the Magician's Nephew bombs and the Cliff Booth movie bomb and they just don't do it anymore, right? But I do think we saw true winds of change in the back third of this month, right? So on May 22nd, The Mandalorian and Grogu comes out. It's released by Disney to middling reviews, more or less indifference, and what amounts to indifference at the box office as well for a franchise of this, you know, renown. It earned $81 million over 3 days. This is the worst opening ever for a Star Wars live action film. But something else happened that weekend that was of great interest. The horror movie Obsession from Curry Barker and Focus Features earned nearly 40% more in its second weekend than its first. Now, it is almost impossible to emphasize how rare this is. Like, if you pay attention to the box office, you know that this never happens. This never happens. We measure films and their popularity by declines, right, from weekend to weekend. And when it's a really good decline, it's like, Get Out dropped 15% in its second weekend. And we're like, oh my God, 15% drop. That's amazing. Again, this movie increased by nearly 40% without jumping notably in screen count. That does not happen. Just doesn't happen, right? The next weekend, May 29th, this past weekend, Obsession jumped again between 10 and 15%, something like that. Again, this does not happen. As best as I can tell, the last time a movie increased in its first 3 weekends of a wide release is E.T. the Extraterrestrial. That's 42 years ago, 43 years ago, 44 years ago. I can't do math. A long time. It's a long time is what I'm saying. This does not happen. This is a thing that does not happen. But Obsession's $26 million gross was dwarfed by the biggest story of the weekend, which is the $81 million opening for Backrooms, the new film from YouTube phenom Kane Parsons. Here's another way of putting this. I just said the number 81 million. One of America's most beloved franchises just earned as much as a $10 million indie film made by a YouTuber on its opening weekend. It was outgrossed in its second weekend by another film made by a different YouTuber that was in its third weekend. These are movies that are made by Gen Z filmmakers for Gen Z audiences dealing with Gen Z problems, attitudes, and fears. And that's kind of amazing. That is an amazing, this is a little story all in and of itself right here. I think it's great. Again, these are the weeks that people write books about. We just happen to be living through it. Peter, how does it feel to be a witness to history?
This is the revolution. It's happening. This is the thing that we've in some ways been circling around on this podcast since we started in 2019, which is we've talked a lot about YouTube, and none of us are big native YouTube viewers. But something we've, you know, sort of I've tried to say is like, I think there's stuff happening there that we don't know about, that we're not paying attention to. And you have to assume that if you give a whole generation of kids filmmaking tools, everybody's got a camera in their pocket, your phone can act as an editor, and digital editing software, effects software is quite accessible, relatively inexpensive these days. If you give a generation of teenagers filmmaking tools, some of them will become filmmakers. And it took a little longer than I thought it was going to take to happen, but it just happened. Like, it's here. And this is not just these two this weekend. There's another one not that long ago, Iron Lung by Markiplier, the YouTuber, who made a video game adaptation for $3 million that earned $50 million, $51 million at the box office. It's a huge, huge multiple on the production cost there. And it was from a YouTube guy. And what at least the Iron Lung film and this and Backrooms have in common is that they're not just YouTube movies. They're very, very clearly made by video game brain boys. And we'll talk more about Backrooms later, but this is YouTube video game culture, sort of online lore. Like all of this stuff is just going to become it's going to become the IP of the next 10 or 15 years. And what superhero movies have been since 2012, really since 2005 or so, we are going to see the internet and internet culture become what movies are. And movies and YouTube, meanwhile, first of all, movies are going to draw from YouTube and probably make a bunch of money off of this. But also movies and YouTube are going to become more and more of the same thing. There's just going to be a conversation back and forth between them where things are going to go directly to YouTube, start on YouTube, or maybe start in the theater and end up on YouTube rather than the other way around. And in some ways, this is a totally new thing. This is the revolution. There is another way to look at this, which is this is just Hollywood finally waking up to, if you want to attract Gen Z moviegoers, then you have to tell stories and set them in environments that Gen Z understands. You have to speak to them in their own language. And it turns out the 20-year-olds know how to do that, and 50-year-old movie executives, and maybe even 40-something podcasters don't know how.
Yeah, I'm gonna talk about this a little more when we talk about Backrooms. But I think what's interesting about both of these movies is that they both work as standalone films. Like they work as films. Which is nice, but they are also both very tied into, they're very keyed into, you know, post-millennial, early Gen Z, late Gen Z fears and anxieties. And that's really, I mean, again, that's what's both most exciting and most refreshing about it. Because I joked about this in my newsletter, but like, I'm an old person. I don't know any of these people. I have no knowledge of the ARG. That, you know, backrooms game, the alternative reality game. Like none of this means anything to me, but just as a piece of filmmaking, it works just like Night of the Living Dead works, just like, you know, Escape from New York works. These are movies. They are movies that work as movies. And there's something actually kind of comforting about that. Alyssa, what do you make of this, like, weird week? It's a very weird week. This does not happen.
So I find it super interesting, in part because of the way it makes me reflect on sort of one of the worst bets I ever made about the future of the entertainment industry and politics, which is that I sort of hoped that the nicheification of pop culture would end up de-escalating the culture wars because everybody could get some of what they wanted. And I was obviously completely and utterly wrong about that. Like, it did not work out that way at all. This is what I get for being a cockeyed optimist. I'm obviously a fool. But I think part of what is interesting about this moment is there's been this question about whether YouTube is going to kill movies and television. And I think, in fact, like, they can coexist, not least because YouTube can kind of function as the new version of the sort of development academies that the studios used to run, right? And those were very sort of talent oriented, right? Like, you'd take a young woman in, you'd reshape her appearance, you would give her, you know, singing lessons, you would, you know, you sort of had these writers' rooms. But now, you know, as Peter pointed out, technology has made the development of certain kinds of talent democratized, right? And it's not just behind the camera, right? Because the number of people who are filming themselves and therefore training themselves, not just as directors, not just as effects artists, but as actors, you know, that process has been radically democratized, and people are going to respond to market forces instead of studio notes. They're going to respond to algorithms instead of studio notes as well. But, you know, clearly YouTube and Hollywood can find a symbiosis if YouTube becomes both an independent product and a successful sort of development program for a new generation of writers and actors and filmmakers.
Just a sort of short note on that is that Chase Infinity, who played Willa, Leonardo DiCaprio's daughter in One Battle After Another, got her start on YouTube, not actually as an actress in a traditional sense. She was part of a K-pop dance cover group.
Yep. And there are going to be all of these ways that people practice performing, learn how to do makeup, learn how to craft, you know, sort of images and narratives and, you know, manage their own publicity. The ability to learn, again, not just filmmaking, but all of the aspects of the business are suddenly there for everyone. And everyone is kind of doing it anyway, right? And some people will do it with more focus and intentionality than others. But I do think that what's exciting about this is not, I mean, to a certain extent, it's the content. I haven't seen Obsession, and I suspect it's stabbier than I would really care.
You wouldn't like it. You would not
yes.
like it.
But I think it's the sort of technical and business symbiosis that feels most exciting to me.
This feels to me like what happened in the 1970s with this sort of wave of young filmmakers taking over. And it specifically feels like it is drawing on the George Lucas tradition. And Lucas has been on my mind because of Star Wars opening, also because he's got this incredible looking museum opening in Los Angeles in a couple of months. And George Lucas, Chicago. We've talked about this, it's opening in Los Angeles. Chicago passed on it.
What?
Oh, Chicago I and San Francisco. Chicago and San Francisco both basically said, no, we don't want to do this, or not literally said no, but many regulatory burdens
that he had to end up
doing this in Los Angeles. And so some of that's, you know, he's kind of in the air right now. And I've been thinking about his legacy. And one thing I always think about is this never quite fully confirmed, but it's been in some books and it's, you know, sort of rumored on the internet for a while, which was that when George Lucas saw the first cut of The Force Awakens, you know, this is the first Star Wars movie that he didn't have a direct role in, that he was no longer overseeing the IP. He said that his big disappointment was that it didn't push the technological barriers, the limits of technology any further, right? It was all just kind of retro nostalgia, sort of playing up stuff from the original trilogy. And Lucas was, first and foremost, a technology guy. Yeah, he was a storyteller, and he loved pulp, and he loved even, you know, sort of, actually, it turns out, like, much sort of more kind of obscure and, you know, sort of high-end art as well. But, like, he was a technology guy and wanted to use filmmaking technology to show us things that we'd never seen before. And over the next 40 years or so, filmmaking technological advances were pretty much all built around this idea of Lucas's, which was, we should use technology and it should show you something that you couldn't see up until we figure out how to show it to you. And so you get Jurassic Park and Terminator 2 and all of this, right? And this is another technological revolution, but it's not a revolution in terms of what you can see, because we've already surpassed that moment. You can already show people anything on screen. If you can imagine it, if you can draw it, you can put it on screen in film form. But what is new is that Kane Parsons developed this web series that became the movie Backrooms entirely on his own, on his computer. He wasn't even shooting actors to start with. This was mostly a 3D modeled environment created in a program called Blender that he just sort of like then walks you around in that environment. Right. And it's a first person view like a video game, because he grew up in video game culture. He's talked about how the game Portal is something that he really that he's influenced by and would like to even to adapt into a movie. And what you see is, this is somebody who figured out how to do all of the things that filmmakers do with sets and actors and sort of space and physical stuff. And he was able to do it entirely from his bedroom on his laptop just using software. And that's a technological revolution, both in the ability to make those things and then the ability to distribute them and get tens or hundreds of millions of people to watch, as Kane Parsons has been able to do with his YouTube channel.
Can I ask you two sort of a tunnel question? Because part of what strikes me about the movies of sort of 1968, 69, 70, I'm thinking like Bonnie and Clyde, Easy Rider, you know, is those were made by those movies were made by people who were, I mean, Arthur Penn was in his 50s, Dennis Hopper was 33. But part of what was striking about them was not necessarily a technological leap, but a sort of a tone and a frankness and a worldview that was in some cases just really shocking to people. It, you know, was the revelation of kind of an outsider mentality that had been, had grown up in part in response to the stifling conformity of the 1950s, late early 1960s. Is there something, again, having not seen Obsession, having seen Backrooms, you know, there have been some artistic efforts to sort of express that something is going on with younger people that older people might be shocked by, right? Like Euphoria is probably the most sort of talked about version of this. But was there something in the worldview of either Obsession or Backrooms that either of you found strikingly millennial, because or strikingly sort of Zoomer? Because it,
yeah,
I wouldn't say Backrooms felt that way to me. But I would be curious to see if you both see a sort of attitudinal or social break in some of these movies, along with sort of a radical break in the business development model and the democratization of technology.
I was planning on talking about this a little bit.
Great, we can do it later.
In the backroom section. Peter, have you seen Obsession?
I have not. I'm going to try and see it later this week.
Yeah. I'll talk about that in a little bit when we discuss Backrooms. But I do think, I think more so in Obsession, I think there is more of a worldview idea in Obsession than there is in Backrooms, though Backrooms has its own kind of interesting thing going on. But again, I'll talk about that a little more when we get to that.
I do actually, I think having not seen Obsession, I think Backrooms clearly represents a distinctly Gen Z-ish perspective, simply in the fact that virtually all of the referential material comes from video games and internet lore. And it is,
well, but
right,
also from the 90s, right? It's a very, I mean, there is,
but it's, that's
in and
all,
of itself.
It, yes, there's David Lynch and there's Stanley Kubrick and 90s stuff, but the 90s is this sort of haunted past.
Yes,
in,
that's
right?
What
it's
I mean.
Empty malls and empty, you know, office buildings, and that is, and that emptiness comes from disuse over time, and also a lot of this sort of sense of just the way that society kind of cleared out of its spaces during the pandemic. And
yeah.
I mean, again, this kid. He's sorry. This filmmaker is 21 today. So in 2020, when, you know, the pandemic was happening, he was 16, 15?
15.
Through that. And that was, you know, when he started learning how to make these films and putting them together. And so much of their worldview is formed in a kind of weird, lonely internet, like it's weird, lonely, it's eerie because of the loneliness to it, and then all of the references, the only world you actually know is the internet world, and that is Backrooms. And you don't, it's, I think it's pretty hard to capture that if you are in your 40s, because probably, I mean, if just for a bunch of reasons, but just to name one, if you were in your 40s during the pandemic, sure, people had, that were quite alone and were locked down. And I don't want to say that no one used to, like, I had a rough time, right? Like, you could probably hear it on some podcasts. And I don't want to underplay that, but more people in their 40s would have had established social communities, right? Been more likely to have, say, a nicer apartment or a house or a space that was theirs, right? Sort of, and like the experience of being quite young and living through that just must have been so strange and such a break from everything you've ever known. And I just think that comes out so clearly in this movie.
Yeah. No. I was just curious about it. The 90s nostalgia stuff is also very prevalent in fashion and in like sort of modern teenage girl culture in a lot of ways that is not really captured here, but it's sort of another expression of that. So it's just something on my mind.
Yeah. So, exit question here. I don't know if you guys have thought, I was just curious if you had a good title for this book about this moment. Like, what do we call this? What do we, you know, from Hoth to the back rooms? I don't know. It's a weird thing.
The revolution will be posted.
Revolution will be posted. The revolution will be streamed. That's it. That's it.
Someone give Sunny a book contract. It'd be a good book. I want to read it.
Yeah, that'd be nice. All right. Let us move on.
Yeah, but no book leave from the podcast.
Well, I mean, no, obviously not.
No, we're not all giving that here.
Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com for our bonus episode on Tilly Norwood, the AI actress, scare quotes, who recently told the New York Times she isn't planning on killing us, thankfully. I guess. And now on to the main event, Backrooms. All right. So this is a movie that started out as a 4chan post, like highlighting liminal spaces. And then it kind of evolved into an augmented reality game by Ken Parsons, who is the director of this, and his YouTube page. Backrooms is the unexpected hit of the summer. It's interesting because I've seen people talk about this being original or not IP. That's not precisely correct. As we discussed before, there's a lot of backstory here. This is a thing that Gen Z audiences know and we're excited about, right? And it reminds me a little bit of, remember a couple years back when Five Nights at Freddy's did like $80 million in its first weekend, right? Backrooms is a Gen Z native property. It's something that appeals to them, to the youngs. It's something of a black box to us olds, I just mention all this because I have no thoughts on how this plays into any of the previous iterations of what, you know, we might think of as its IP. I don't care about any of that. But I do have some thoughts on the movie. We got some spoilers coming up here, as always. So if you are worried about that sort of thing, go see the movie. Turn this off. Go see the movie. Come back and then listen to it. All right. That's fine. Well, I don't take offense to it. All right. Thought number one, you don't actually need to be a young person at all to enjoy this movie, right? It stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's 48, as Clark, the owner of a furniture store who is disappointed with his life. He's living in the store because his wife has kicked him out. He's kind of a jerk. He resents having to support her, and he resents not being able to be an architect and build things. It also stars Renata Rensvi, 38, as Mary. She's a psychiatrist. She's trying to help Clark overcome his feelings of failure and get over her own childhood traumas, right? When Clark discovers a secret dimension of infinite space in the basement of his furniture store, he sets out to explore it, only to seemingly get lost on the inside, which prompts Mary to go looking for him. Horror ensues, which leads me to thought number two. This is really, it's a really effective horror movie, but it's one that does a kind of an interesting thing in that it's merging different horror genres, right? It opens with a found footage riff, right? It's a POV VHS recording of a man running through the, you know, kind of titular yellow tinged back rooms in fear for his life. Why is he scared? What is after him? Who is watching this tape after the fact? All will be revealed, maybe. Not really. It like kind of evolves into a psychological thriller about internal turmoil erupting into external projections of violence. And then at the end, it's kind of a slasher film with a big gory set piece and an unkillable monster and, you know, a final girl and all that. And in this way, in this kind of blended mixture of horror films, it feels a little like YouTube itself, right? A place where genres mix together and you watch clips of movies just one after the other and everything kind of merges. Everything kind of melds together. Thought number three, I love the whole kind of liminal space subgenre, right? These ideas of fake worlds where reality turns in on itself. You saw it in Exit 8, which I believe Peter and I discussed a few weeks back. It's representative, I think, of this generation's existence in a sort of unreality, right? Like, what is the internet but a giant liminal space? It's this vast self-iterating wilderness that kind of resembles society, but doesn't actually all that often intersect with reality. And when it does intersect with reality, it usually ends up with somebody like losing their job or killing themselves. There is also a reason why obsession has struck a real chord with audiences. And this is a, you know, Obsession is not a liminal space movie. It's not, that's not what it's doing. But it is a movie at heart about the biggest question in modern relationships, right? It's a movie about consent and who can give it and when it can be taken for real as opposed to, you know, coerced by intoxication or by social pressures. And it's about the idea of social performance of consent as well. There's like this idea of whether or not other people consent to the consent. It's a really interesting kind of bundle of anxieties. And there's no surprise to me that young audiences have been showing up for this en masse. Like it just hits at a thing that they're really concerned about. Thought number four is this is not a perfect film. And the weakest part by far is the kind of overly literalized psychologizing of the film, right? Like Clark's anger manifests as a big angry Clark puppet that eats people. Sure. Like Mary slaying this dragon with the piece of the rock from her destroyed childhood home that her hoarder mother had locked her inside of, right? Like, okay, somebody was really paying attention to the Freud subsection of their high school sociology class. Alyssa, as the non-horror fan of the group, I'm very curious about your reaction to Backrooms. Was it too scary for you?
It was not. It was very funny. The friend that I saw it with does not have Peter's level of familiarity with the things that freak me out. And so I sat down and I was like, I don't like stabbing. I don't like eye damage. And he told me afterwards that he got to the kitchen sequence and like Clark's got a knife and there's a guy with 10 eyes. And he's like, this is going to be like all of Alyssa's nightmares. It was quite funny. I found the movie most effective in its first sort of two thirds. Everything before Mary encounters Clark in the back rooms, I thought was much scarier and more effective than anything that happens afterwards. And I think a lot of it is, as you said, Sunny, you know, the sort of very thuddingly obvious, you know, the back rooms are in fact our minds metaphor. But it was interesting. It's interesting to me to hear both of you talk about this movie as sort of a reflection of the pandemic of the internet, because it actually brought to mind two works from much earlier, far before the pandemic. The first is Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, which I read at Peter's recommendation. And is about these astronauts exploring an alien spacecraft that is unfathomably huge, empty, and sort of designed in ways that they can only sort of speculate about, but that never really, that the questions they have are never resolved within the text of the book. And I gather there's a sequel or sequels that I haven't read, but you know, part of what is spooky about that book is the sense that there is an inner logic or intelligence at work that you're just never going to have access to. And the sense that you will go, maybe you'll go back to your reality, but the world will be sort of, your perception of the world will be forever changed. The second is Susanna Clarke's Piranesi, which I don't think either of you have read, but is a really wonderful little novel. It is, you know, it is told from the perspective of a character who is wandering a sort of seemingly limitless maze. There are some skeletons in the maze. There is an ocean that periodically rises and floods some of the other levels. But otherwise, again, there is this person who is just sort of at the mercy of an unseen intelligence who cannot sort of fathom the reason for his world. And I think this sense of unreality, of sort of a realm beyond, has a very long history, right? I mean, you know, the whole idea of fairy, for example, in sort of English and, you know, Irish and Welsh mythology is predicated on the idea that there is sort of an unseen, extremely powerful intelligence at work that exists in a parallel world that we can sort of accidentally wander into, that our children can disappear into. And so I think this particular manifestation of the sort of liminal spaces of the 90s is pandemic specific, but the sense that the world we're living in is just a veil and that there is something else out there that is kind of beyond our comprehension is certainly a very old trope. And I think, you know, I found this one to be quite an effective expression of that, right? And the disappearance not into something that is wondrous, like the kingdoms of fairy or the, you know, the beautiful maze of Piranesi or, you know, the grandeur of the spaceship in Rendezvous with Rama, I think does kind of represent something new. It's sort of a, you know, a vision of our own irrelevance, right? Of our sort of extinction as a species. But yeah, I just found everything involving like the actual psychology and the monsters to be essentially totally uninteresting and ineffective. It just did not resonate with me at all. And I mean, I think it's maybe worth noting that, you know, Kim Peters didn't write the script. He didn't write the screenplay. I don't think he's even listed as a co-writer on it. And so he's
so,
very
so
effective.
So Kane Parsons is just listed as director. It's Will Sodick, who is a TV writer who wrote the screenplay. But I have seen reports, and I'm somewhat unclear on this myself, that, you know, he was Kane Parsons, after his initial Backrooms short went viral, you know, did like 10 million views in 2 weeks, was approached by a lot of producer types. And he said, you know, something like, well, most of them just wanted to make a fairly traditional slasher movie. And I didn't want to do that. So eventually he ends up with like the A24 Atomic Monster group. And I read a line somewhere. I can't remember what piece it was. It said he picked his producers and spent months, or it was a year or something, working on the story. So that there is a suggestion in some of the reporting that he was involved with, maybe not literally sitting down and writing the words of the screenplay and the dialogue and the stage directions, but in crafting the story to some degree or another. And the story does, the thing about the psychology is, I agree with you, this movie is weaker in its third act for sure. But the psychology of the movie is built not just around this sort of Freudian idea, but around the idea of loops, of staying in your, like you're stuck in a loop, right? And you're trying to get out of it. And that seems to me plausibly, at least, to be an idea that came out of Kane Parsons' mind, because he's clearly a video gamer. And that's game terminology. That's a game idea. I mean, in the game business, you literally talk about what is a game's core loop. And that's, I think it was one of the designers of Halo who was just like, well, it's 30 seconds of fun, right? The idea is you're just trying to create that 30 sec. But like either way, what the core loop of gameplay, right, is this is an idea that is heavily built into gaming, right, in a whole bunch of different ways. You saw it actually in Exit 8. I know you didn't see that movie, Alyssa, but Exit 8 is very much about this idea of being stuck in these loops and trying to find some way out of them. And then it kind of does some interesting stuff with transforming the game's vision of puzzle loops into something more about advancing as a human being and getting stuck at, you know, not in yourself. But that's very similar to the idea that we see here in Backrooms, which is that this sort of sense of stuckness, you know, of being lost in the maze of the game, is a sort of it's a psychological swamp that you get, you know, a bog, right, that you get mired down in. And that's kind of interesting to see two of these movies that have video game valence by relatively young filmmakers, both sort of address this idea of we're, you know, the thing in life that matters, like the struggle, the mental struggle is to get out of your loop, your self-destructive loop.
Yeah. And I think that's something that also has a lot in common with sort of the popularity of Jordan Peterson, of a lot of sort of advice gurus in who are speaking to young men in particular, right? The idea that like you can sort of break free of old patterns and kind of move forward with, you know, to level up in your life, right? Just sort of as you would in a video game. But again, I get all of this and I get it as a video game reference, but it still didn't land particularly hard for me as, you know, psychology.
No, it's by far the weakest part of the movie. And again, it just feels very literal. It's very like, okay, that's a way to go with it. Though I did like the like kind of weird puppet man design of the monster Clark. I don't know. Like, it's so weird and unusual, and the way the doubles are presented as kind of fractured conceptions of self. Again, I like it. It has this kind of Lynchian quality to it that is appealing. I don't know. One thing we haven't discussed at all is, you know, so Mark Duplass shows up in this as a scientist who says something about MRI machines, and then they opened up portals into, I don't know, whatever this is, MRI machines help them discover these places, which again, I find kind of interesting, but mostly interesting from a, from my franchising perspective, because you can absolutely see how you could peg a whole franchise on, like, here's this guy, he's actually the one who's exploring the back rooms, which leads me to, like, kind of the broader visual idea of the film, which is that this is about watching people, right? Like all of the visual cues in this are like Duplass watching these people through a VHS recording or through a secret camera that's been put up on the wall, or people like getting the VHS tapes and watching it. You get a little hint of this in the film that Mark Duplass's family is watching when we cut to him in his home. They're watching The Neverending Story, and they're very specifically watching the part where Sebastian is seen reading the story, and everything is kind of happening around him as he is reading it. Because again, there's this voyeuristic quality to this thing, which I think this actually works better as a pure visual idea and image, but it is still very literal as well. This idea that we are always being watched all the time.
Yeah.
That's right. And that comes from, I think, again, a sort of big part of YouTube gaming culture crossover, which is watching people play video games, watching streamers, watching, you know, recordings of people playing video games on YouTube is, in fact, something that lots of young people do a huge amount of, is just, they're not playing the game themselves. They are just watching somebody else. And there's, you know, sort of a voiceover often while, you know, not all the games are in first person, but many of them are, right? And then you're watching somebody sort of narrate their playing. But the other thing that did was it linked this movie, which is based on this sprawling kind of internet lore and folk mythology, to a different sprawling internet lore and folk mythology. Do you guys know about the SCP Foundation and the book, There Is No Anti-Mimetics Division? Okay, so there's this whole, first of all, you should just, everybody who's listening to this podcast, and also both of you, should read the book, There Is No Anti-Mimetics Division. But this comes out of a kind of collaborative, weird internet horror lore project where you describe utterly banal sort of normal things, but in very bureaucratic and plain, like, kind of regulatory language. And then you will describe, say, some weird properties that it has, possibly evil properties, possibly just strange, mysterious, unexplored, you know, unexplained properties. The novel version of this that was sort of built out of a series, I think, of short stories and then kind of linked together, is excellent, twisty, sort of terrifying, kind of strange. But this is its whole, like, there is a sort of discrete version of this in the novel, There Is No Anti-Mimetics Version. But then there's also this kind of sprawling, you can kind of call it collaborative, you can almost call it fan fiction, in that there's this sense that everybody can contribute to it, right? You can write, a description of a mug in bureaucratic language, and at the end, write the mug, you say something like, every time you pour water into it, the water seems to disappear. And that maybe that's all there is to it. And maybe there's a whole lot more, and it can kind of sprawl and go on for forever. And that's so much of what this movie is doing, is not just sort of telling one little discrete story, though it does that, and I think reasonably well, again, with some caveats about the third act. This movie is kind of linking this particular bit of internet lore to a huge amount of other kind of underground internet lore that I think the Gen Z viewers, who, you know, younger than us, are going to understand that this is part of that in a way that, say, 40-year-old podcasters might not off the top of their head. Although I actually read that book a couple of years ago. It's great.
I was wondering what the two of you thought about the movie's take on therapy culture, which also seems, I don't know if it seems distinctly Gen Z, although I do think that, that is a generation that has been, you know, where therapy, there's been a lot of sort of therapeutics. There's been a lot of young people who are on various psychiatric medications. Do you think the movie is saying that therapy is useless? I wasn't sure about that.
Well, one thing I wrote in my review is that the therapist's office is itself kind of a weird liminal space, right? Which in what I mean is that, like, when you go to a furniture store, which is where a lot of this movie is set, a furniture store is a very weird place. It's like a place that has 17 different living rooms in it. Like, that doesn't exist. That's not furniture stores are weird. I've always thought furniture stores are very weird places. So I was very much in tune with this movie. I don't like furniture stores. They creep me out. And so this movie did a lot. This movie had a lot going for it right there. But a therapist's office is much the same way, right? Like, what is a therapist's office? It's a fake living room or a fake bedroom, or it's like a fake space where you are supposed to be made to feel comfortable. And that in and of itself makes me feel uncomfortable. Which
also,
I think,
if you think about the back rooms as a kind of space, you know, a journey into the endlessness of your own mind, I think there is a comparison there to be made that the movie is making to some degree a comparison with therapy, which is that it's this sort of endless journey and you don't know, right? You're just sort of exploring these rooms and sometimes it's empty or there's a couple of chairs and sometimes there's a monster and everything's dirty and upside down.
But to your point, Alyssa, I do think the movie is somewhat critical of therapy culture and therapy speak, and this kind of like wishy-washy idea of everyone can just talk through their problems, or we just need to you just need to get it all. One thing I actually think it does as well, to touch on a different generational touchstone, is I think it comes to kind of the same conclusion that The Sopranos came to, which is that therapy culture was kind of enabling Tony Soprano to be a bad person. And I think much the same thing is happening here with Clark. Like, he is not being forced to confront that he is actually the problem. Even though I do think she is trying a little harder to make him see that. Eventually, she just has to say it to him, which is what winds up leading to the monster eating himself. Which is kind of interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, it also just is a depiction of therapy. Like, the back rooms itself is sort of a replication of the therapeutic technique that Mary is using, of having Clark sort of role play this moment over and over again, right? And it creates different versions of the same event, none of which are the same as the actual event. And they're all a little bit distorted. They're all a little bit off in some way. And you know, the movie, like, Clark gets sort of eaten by his duplicate, and we know that there is now this distorted duplicate of Mary out there as well. And so I think there's a very interesting question about, like, what does it mean to retell these narratives over and over and over again so that these multiple versions of them exist in your head? Like, there's an extent to which the movie is sort of skeptical of introspection, I think, in a way that is sort of fascinating. Like, maybe you can't live in the furniture store. Maybe you can't go back to that night. Maybe you just sort of have to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, if this movie teaches us nothing else, it's that you can't live in a furniture store because it's not a real place. All right.
Yes.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Backrooms? Alyssa?
Thumbs up, but with caveats.
Thumbs up. This is a very well-directed movie. I think it has some script issues that come to the fore in the third act, but this is someone with a real talent for the audiovisual side of filmmaking.
Thumbs up. I mean, I like, again, not perfect. I would not say that this is the most stunning debut film I've ever seen, but it's really good, especially because it's made by a 19-year-old YouTuber. Good movie, and it's very effective at what it sets out to do, which is be a creepy, creepy film. So good job, guys. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.